Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, we're not drinking wine. We're
not even drinking
beer.
No, it's sad.
We're both hoarse. We both have throat issues. We're drinking tea.
I know, and you gave me a mug that says, from Minnesota with love, which is perfect because it is freaking cold outside tonight.
And in Washington, D.C. last weekend, it was like 70 degrees outside. Mm-hmm. I was in my backyard, like, raking and sweeping, and I was wearing a t-shirt, and now I'm freezing to death.
Yep.
And I think that's why we're all a little sick.
Maybe a little hot toddy next time would be nice, though, a little shot of something in the tea.
All right.
Keep that in mind.
We can work on that. Welcome back to the 1990s. Bad Boys.
What you gonna do?
Michael Bay cut his teeth on Bad Boys in 1995, and then he brought out a sequel in 2003. I saw these a long, long time ago, so I think just like you, I spent last week catching up, reacquainting myself with Mike Lowrey and Marcus Burnett, Will Smith and Martin Lawrence, and they're back in Bad Boys for Life. A title they're probably going to wish they saved for Bad Boys 4, which apparently is already in the works. This Lethal Weapon ripoff, I mean homage, repairs the two. They're older now. They're not in their 20s. They're not in their 30s. In fact, they're in their 50s. Hannah, our audience loved it. What did you think about Bad Boys for Life?
Well, I had not been acquainted with them before last week, and so luckily they were both available on Netflix streaming, and so I did watch both back-to-back last weekend, which was very helpful in giving me just sort of that foundation for the characters and their relationships and any of the backstory that might come into play. And so, but also by having just seen the previous two in succession, I can tell you without a doubt that 3, Bad Boys for Life, is probably 100% better than Bad Boys 2 was in 2003, but not quite as good, I don't think, as the original Bad Boys in 1995, because back then, it was a fresh pairing. And so there's sort of that law of diminishing returns to some degree. But I do think that Bad Boys for Life goes a long way in bringing the franchise back to a place where they can keep going, because 2 was really kind of narratively just a mess.
I remember 2 was very, I didn't realize, it was very long.
Yes, almost 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm. Going. I don't know, and honestly, I don't know if Bad Boys for Life is my favorite or worst or in the middle. I just can't tell, because I can't get behind this odd couple. Will Smith is he's the hothead, but he's also the smooth operator. Like, he can get around town in his fast, shiny cars and get all the women. Martin Lawrence is the bumbling fool. He's the one who's married with children and always he's the more reticent of the two. You gotta slow down. You gotta think this through. And Martin Lawrence just gets on my nerves. It's just, the way he yells all of his lines and with a big wide-eyed expression, that's his baseline acting maneuver. I believe he was retired and he came back for this. And this is also the first time Will Smith gets top billing. And actually in 95, if you remember, Martin Lawrence was bigger than Will Smith was. Independence Day had not hit yet.
Oh.
He was only known for Fresh Prince and like 6 Degrees of Separation.
Martin, interesting. Yeah. So the role certainly reversed over the course of the past 25 years. I didn't have the same problem with it that you did. I mean, yes, it's more of the same. And so any fan of the franchise, they know exactly what to expect. So I do think if you were a fan of 1 and 2, you can't go wrong seeing 3, because it is better than 2. And, you know, like any other, I think you compared it to a comfortable slipper.
It's because people in our audience were waiting for what they know was coming. They were,
yeah.
They know that the camera shot looking upwards in slow motion that pans around the duo and it's like really hot outside. You know that's coming. You know Joe Pantoliano is the captain. Is going to be drinking Pepto-Bismol and yelling, "You've stepped out of line one more time, you two." And you just know it's coming.
You know it's coming, but also if that didn't come, you'd be disappointed. Mm. And so where else could it go than to sort of reacquaint you with the dynamics of the past? But it does introduce a new generation as well with this so-called ammo unit of millennial cops.
Well, they're,
you know, so that's the future.
It's not forced. It actually kind of works. There's this new school versus old school intergenerational rivalry. Will Smith is like, of course I know how to do everything. I'm old school. I know how to go in there, take the meat tenderizer to DJ Khaled's hands and get answers. But now you got Vanessa Hudgens and Alexander Ludwig and Chris Melton, and they're, you know, hackers. And they just do everything a little bit more technological. They have spy drones, and they make fun of each other. You're so old. You're so young. It mostly works.
I think it works. I think it was actually fine. And they had a fun little dynamic. And so you could easily see how, if and when this movie makes enough at the box office, which I'm sure it will, that if I just hope that they don't make the same mistake that was made with Bad Boys 2, where they went forward with doing it when they obviously did not have a very good script in hand. And whereas in the first one, my biggest surprise with going back to the 1995 version was seeing a very young Tia Leone, and it was her breakthrough role. And I didn't realize, here she is all these years later playing Madam Secretary. And to me, it was just really kind of fascinating to see what she looked like way back in the day. And then Gabrielle Union was like totally wasted in the second one with her role. And so this one, I think, cohesively much, much stronger than, you know, in terms of the narrative than the second one. But it's fun. I mean, our audience enjoyed it because they were getting those nods to some of the previous stuff. I totally laughed when it opens up and you see a certain person reemerging from the end, near the end of the previous one. And so I thought that really was helpful. And we're all aging at the same pace as these guys. It's kind of like real time shift. And so you could identify with a lot of, or I certainly could, with a lot of the jokes about where they're at in their lives. Because really, it's a pretty, it's a long time between sequels.
Well, and it's so, 25 years since the first one.
Yeah.
And Michael Bay's gone. Jerry Bruckheimer went out and hired two guys in their 30s who say they idolized the first two films when they were kids. These are Moroccan-born, Brussels-based partners, Adil El Arbi and Bilal Fallah. Mostly unknowns. They've cut their teeth, in the indie world a little bit. And Bruckheimer saw something in their films and said, I think you can carry this franchise. And since I think it's about to make a whole ton of money, word on the street is Bruckheimer is also going to hire this pair to do Beverly Hills Cop 4.
And that's going to feel exactly the same because I can totally see that. They do follow the blueprint that Michael Bay laid out with those first two. So in terms of that combination of comedy, action, bullets flying everywhere, lots of high body count, frenetic pacing, it's all very consistent with the previous two. And I definitely can see them kind of carrying on that tradition. And it is. You have to sort of be okay. Like, I took a friend who was expecting it to be funnier, more comedy than mm-hmm. action.
These two have always been known as more action-oriented.
It's an R-rated action buddy cop movie. And while the bullets stop flying long enough to occasionally have, land a punchline or two, it is a pretty... there's a lot of collateral damage with these films. A little John Wickish, I would say, in its level of violence. And so,
oh please, don't overdo it.
But it's closer to that than to a Beverly Hills Cop. So I think if you had to just sort of figure, people need to be forewarned that it's not all comedy. So if you haven't seen the first two, I absolutely would recommend at least watching the first one. Which is still only about 2 hours. This one goes back to just a 2-hour running time, which is smart. But there are all those little tidbits of information that come up in two that will help you in understanding all the relationships that exist in three.
I think this is going to make all the money in the world because Bad Boys and Bad Boys 2 have spent the last 20 years on TNT and TBS, and everybody has just seen it in the background over and over again. They're ready. As much as it just annoys me, yes, it's gonna kill.
I'm just glad that it's better than two. I think that was very important, and that I don't think they should have even.
They didn't have any dead bodies coming out the truck, though.
Oh my gosh, the heads did not roll quite to the extent that they did in two. But I think it would have been a completely different story if this had been truly the law of diminishing returns and if three had actually been worse than two. Since that's not the case, I think it's certified fresh for a valid reason.
It was not Beverly Hills Cop 3. No. I remember that. All right, take us through the second kids movie of the year so far. Robert Downey Jr. is no longer Iron Man. In fact, he's still a leading man, but he's doing something different. He's talking to animals in Doolittle, which is lighting up Twitter in a different manner than Bad
harsh.
Boys is.
It has been harsh. I looked it up. It's 19% right now on Rotten Tomatoes, which I think is completely unfair.
That's low.
It's low and it's ridiculous because if you asked any of the kids who were in the screening, they would give it 100% certified fresh. So it's not fair to balance, you know, to sort of diminish what its value is for kids by what a bunch of adult critics are saying. And it is a reimagining of the classic Dr. Doolittle. Is it as good, even close to anything that you've seen in previous iterations? No. Can't even come close to the Eddie Murphy version of Dr. Doolittle. My favorite will always be the 1967 Rex Harrison musical version. But in this case, Robert Downey Jr. is playing this version of Dr. John Doolittle. Same idea where it's this veterinarian who can communicate with animals. And in this case, he's in Queen Victoria's England, and he's got this thick Welsh accent and very wild-looking hair. Comes off a little buffoonish-looking, but he's this guy who's been in hibernation for 7 years. His wife has died. He's cut himself off from the world, except for the animals that that live with him and he interacts with because they are CGI-talking animals. And Robert Downey Jr. said expressly that, you know, after years of playing Iron Man / Tony Stark and Sherlock Holmes and other R-rated and PG-13 rated characters, he made the very intentional decision to do a PG-rated movie that his kids could see. And that it was about doing something that his kids could enjoy, and he's an animal lover. And so you just gotta kind of step back from just being primed to just diminish what it is and just let the kids enjoy it. Adults should not bother going to see it, but your kid saw the trailer, wants to see this movie.
We're going this weekend.
So, you know, I think you should let him be the judge, and you just should sort of just allow yourself to not hate it.
What? Tell me about the talking CGI animals. Are they up to compare them to the Lion King?
You know, it's tough. I mean, they're a different breed, so to speak. But I do think they've got great the voice talent and the actual other live action characters. They assembled quite the cast for this movie, and so the biggest problem is that Jessie Buckley, who I love, who was in Wild Rose recently. She's basically in a coma for this entire film. I'm like, what a wasted talent. She plays like the young queen who's dying, and Dr. Doolittle has to go and find the cure on this mysterious island somewhere. And that's where it becomes this epic adventure film. But the animals, they're fun enough. You know, you've got Rami Malek playing this like anxious gorilla who kind of needs a therapist. You've got Octavia Spencer is this enthusiastic but rather dim-witted duck. Kumail Nanjiani as an ostrich who is very cynical and is always burying his head in whatever he can find. John Cena as this polar bear. And then you've got Emma Thompson as this parrot who's basically like Doolittle's confidant. And so you've got pretty strong voice characters and they're entertaining to listen to. But you also have Antonio Banderas, Michael Sheen, Jim Broadbent. I mean, you've got quite a phenomenal cast. And so all I can think, and it's written and directed by Stephen Gaghan, who did Syriana and Traffic and Gold. So I have a feeling that they were just all in a place where they wanted to do fluff and just give themselves a breath of fresh air, a little bit of fluff, and this is exactly what that is.
Well, it cost $175 million to make.
That's a lot of fluff.
So they're in for it. They are I'm not saying the actors are necessarily taking heat, but from what I've seen on the tweets, people do not like this script, and they think it's very vulgar. I saw things being pulled out of dragons and whatnot, and oh man, it's going to lose a lot of money.
But it's one of those ones that the kids will still enjoy, and it'll pick up some money later with kids rewatching it. But it's because it's got animals, and you know, it's just to me, it was harmless, and I just am glad that the kids around me enjoyed it. And I don't think it's as painful as the critics are making it out to be for the adults who are in tow when the kids want to go see it. Let them see it. It's not that insufferable.
Well, speaking of kids in film, is the new what looks like a Troop Beverly Hills ripoff, Troop Zero,
but it's not,
on Amazon Prime, is that for children?
It is. It's more of your it's almost like an old school family film. It's streaming now on Amazon. I had no intention of watching it because it did look like some Troop Beverly Hills kind of thing. But I was unable to sleep last night and it was already streaming. So I'm like, okay, I'm just going to watch this. You know, it's like an hour and a half or so. And I was like, how bad can any movie really be when you've got both Grace McKenna, or is it McKenna Grace? McKenna Grace. I always get her name reversed. But you've got Viola Davis. You know, you've got Viola Davis in it, and you've got Allison Janney. You can't go too wrong with those kinds of folks. Jim Gaffigan is in it. And so McKenna Grace is really playing this sort of misfit girl. It takes place in 1977, rural Georgia. And this girl, she had lost her mother, and so it's just her and her dad. And he's like this country lawyer who doesn't ever get paid by anybody. And Viola Davis plays like his assistant, who also sometimes ends up just kind of looking after McKenna Grace. And so it's not quite what you would expect. It's a formulaic film, but it has some surprising turns. And what happens is that the kid, whose name is Christmas Flint, gotta love that name.
Oh, no, you don't.
She dreams about going into outer space and making contact with other life forms. And she ends up recruiting this sort of makeshift group of birdie scouts. They're kind of like Girl Scouts, so that they can qualify to compete for a chance to be recorded on NASA's Golden Record, which is going to feature all these voices from Earth. And it becomes this sort of underdog movie, you know, the misfits versus the mean girls, because there's another troop.
Troop Beverly Hills.
but it takes a turn. It's different. It's not as... I like the fact that it's really about science. And there's a boy in this who's obviously having some gender identity issues and joins this troop as well. But it then becomes about bullying and friendship. And in the end, there's just sort of lessons to be learned for everyone. You know, the mean girls, the misfits, the adults. And this one, too, I'm Rotten Tomatoes certified fresh at 77%. And it's a much more heartwarming, family-friendly message movie, nice drama than I expected it to be. And I'll tell you, this cast elevates it from being a Troop Beverly Hills. And it's formulaic but not completely predictable. The end takes some turns that I think would even surprise you.
Ooh, I don't know. What is surprising is... now that the Oscar nominations are out, there's one of the best international films, it's no longer best foreign film, it's best international film, is nominated by France, and they got one of the five slots, and it's called Les Misérables. This is not Anne Hathaway, this is not Russell Crowe and
Hugh Jackman,
or any Broadway version of what you think it is. Yes, it takes place in Paris. Yes, it takes place, in fact, the same place, one of the same places that Victor Hugo set the novel, and it's in the same neighborhood where I believe he wrote the novel. But it takes place in present day, and a very underclass, downtrodden, oppressed, forgotten section of Paris. Very income inequality type of thing. Very us versus them. Lots of tribes, lots of different sects battling for control. This is brought to you by Mr. Laj Lee, our directors of Bad Boys for Life. Remember, they were from Morocco, now they're Brussels-based. Laj Lee is from Mali, and now he's Paris-based. I just like the symmetry there for whatever reason.
I was like, okay.
This won the Cannes Jury Prize, which is actually second place. It didn't win the Palme d'Or. That was Parasite. This won the Cannes Jury Prize. And I'm, as much as I did like this film, and as much as many people seem to like this film, I'm still shocked that France nominated this as their entry over Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is clearly the superior film.
They're so different.
Les Misérables is not without its... It's just a different feeling, and it's harsh. It's harsh to watch. Little Issa, he's just a, I don't know, 10, 11-year-old boy. He just gets in trouble. He steals something very exotic, and he starts off this wave of cause and effects. Then you got the cops rolling around. You got the guy who thinks he owns the neighborhood, kind of the corrupt cop. And you got Training Day in the back seat, guy with his first day on the job. So it's really, it's like revolution against a broken system. People rise up. This is based on the 2006 riots. Laj Lee lived in the building where the riots kicked off. This is somewhat autobiographical in his Montfermé neighborhood. This is shot on location with many first-time actors. So it's got that visceral, authentic feeling. I really did like it. I certainly did not love it.
Well, I saw it back to back. It was a double feature one day, weeks and weeks and weeks ago, with the one we talked about last week, The Invisible Life, The Two Sisters. And I saw this one first. And luckily, there was an open bar between these two because you needed a decompressor after seeing this film.
They're both heavy. In their own way, they're both very heavy.
It was a very long 5 hours or so. But this film, everyone, you know, really reacted positively to. You know, it's about this sort of small, it's a cop movie, ultimately. It's really about this anti-crime unit trying to maintain the very tenuous peace among all the different people in this particular impoverished neighborhood. But then the cops are kind of, you know, it's like, are they good cops? Are they bad cops? You're not quite sure where it's going. You think they're all bad. And you think everyone's on the take, and some people are on the take, but all it, you know, it's like the piece is just, it's hanging on by a thread. And so what's happening is that thread starts to unravel. And yes, this cycle of violence, this stuff that just happens, and you're just sort of going along, waiting for it all to end. And what was most frustrating to me, a lot of people are talking about how they really loved the ending of this film. I remember specifically feeling that the ending, that there were two endings, that it kept going into a place.
You thought it was ending.
I thought it was over. I thought it was ending. And I was like, fade to black. We're good. No. Interesting ending. No. So then there's a whole other thing. And
Which apparently is kind of what happened.
I guess so, but I could have lived without it. So very divided in terms of how you might feel about this ending. But yeah, I mean, the story kind of meanders a bit, and that final act is just a little like, whoa. and so, I don't know, it's kind of more of a love it or hate it thing. But yeah, as this neighborhood kind of spirals out of control, it's a very, it's a foreign film. You can call it international if you want, but yes,
it's
a foreign film.
Because of the title, I was trying to connect it. Don't try too hard, but I believe there are connections. The Chris, who is pretty much the bad cop, he's Javert. Little Issa, he's kind of Jean Valjean. And it's, yes, it's tenuous, but
yeah,
there are connections. That neighborhood apparently has been that way, I guess, since Victor Hugo wrote this in, what, the 1860s? I mean, is this where they, you know, the Parisians go just to be forgotten and be oppressed?
There is a scene they actually make reference.
Yeah, he talks about
in the film to Victor Hugo's Les Misérables. But I do think I think it was a mistake not to change the title. I do not think this is a good title for bringing people in.
I mean, translated, it does fit.
Translated, it fits, but I don't think people will understand what it is they're going into because there are too many other Les Misérables movies out there. And so you've got a musical version, you've got a non-musical version, you've got the book. And so to mimic the title, I think actually will keep some people away, or you're going to get people who think they're going in.
No,
for
shame
some new
on them
adaptation.
For not doing just the smallest amount of due diligence.
Oh,
if someone
come on,
walks
you don't
in.
Know, I walk. Sometimes you go into a movie and you're like, I don't know, I didn't read the synopsis.
But this isn't nominated for a reason. People, ears to the ground. I mean, dude, just look at the movie poster. Look at the poster.
But I wouldn't know, because if you thought it was, you know, a reimagining to some degree, like a Dr. Doolittle, you're still going to get a doctor who talks to the animals. This is not...
Everybody in this film is still miserable.
Everyone is Les Miserables for sure. And so it's not going to win.
No,
the Oscar,
not even close. That will be Parasite.
But it will be Parasite. But, you know, whether you would put Portrait of a Lady on Fire is a much more beautiful French film.
It's better on all accounts.
But it's very different. But this one, if you like sort of that gritty kind of on the streets fighting crime and the cops getting mixed up with the neighborhood punks and all that, then that's what this one's for. But I don't think it's going to gain that huge of a fan base.
So yes, it's Oscar time. The nominations were just announced last Monday morning. My first, before I get into shocks and snubs and, you know, ups and downs, I want to lead you into my first question.
Mm-hmm.
There were 9 films nominated for Best Picture. There were 4 double-digit nominees, Joker leading them all with 11, followed by 1917, The Irishman, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. 4 double-digit nominees. I don't believe that's ever happened. My question is this lazy? Did people just go down the list, best costume, best production design, and just write down the same 4 films?
Well, I always feel that way about the technical categories, that if it's like a really well-edited sound kind of film, I feel like sometimes these, you know, a certain movie will run the category. Like on Jeopardy, it's like, yes, sound editing, sound design, give them all, you know, give it to them all, the score. And so I think it's a little bit of laziness, but I think it's also people stacking the deck and trying to make sure that the films that they really, really loved have as big a shot as possible at getting at least something. And sometimes what happens, and I don't know what was going on with all those nominations for Joker, because outside of Joaquin Phoenix, I did not feel that... That deserves 11 nominations.
For example, a very minor category, Best Costume Design. The Irishman and Joker are nominated for Best Costume Design over Dolomite and Rocketman.
And Little Women. I mean, it's...
Even Downton Abbey. costumes for Joker?
Yeah, I mean... What,
are you serious?
What, are you, just because you...
They were so lazy.
You put a little clown costume on somebody?
That is the ultimate, I think, indicator right there. They just went down everything and like, I'm going to nominate Joker for everything I can.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think that's another one that I do feel that the Joker took away spots from much more deserving films. That's the runaway one where I just was like, that's a lot of categories to stack in one film's favor when I just don't think it deserves to be there. And I hope that that's not an indication. I hope it's one of those situations where for the most part it gets shut out. There's the potential, sure. I think
usually,
Joaquin Phoenix is a shoo-in.
Usually the film that has the most nominations doesn't always, but the majority of the time does win.
And in this particular case, that would be a huge mistake.
If that happens, it will be Joker this year.
And that would be a joke.
My biggest oh my God moment is, where is Lupita Nyong'o?
Yes, that was so sad.
Are you kidding me?
It's tough, but and then you go, okay, well, who would you take off the list?
Well, where's your list?
In order for...
I can guarantee you I would take 4 off
Lupita.
The list. I'd take off Cynthia Erivo.
I would take off
Saoirse Ronan. I would take off Renee Zellweger.
Renee Zellweger's going to win.
I understand, but I'd still take her off because it's my opinion, and I didn't care for her in that
but
movie.
But I do. I actually think if you took, I mean, Charlize Theron, I this is one where, like, best makeup, absolutely, because
if I had a vote, I would actually vote for Charlize in this category.
She completely transforms makeup-wise.
I'm just shocked that
It's sad, but it is. It's one of those things where you look through and you go, gosh, I just don't know.
Many people were shocked There was no J-Lo. There was no Jennifer Lopez.
Yeah, that didn't
for
really
Hustlers.
Shock me.
And it didn't shock me because the Oscars are still, you know, you can still expand the voting base as much as you want. It's still very heavy traditionalists. And Jennifer, everyone remembers Jennifer Lopez is not usually in Oscar-caliber films and performances.
Well, not only that, but I think they're very often recognizing the scope of work for a particular actress. And you don't see all that much phenomenal range in the character that J-Lo's playing. Whereas, you know, I think that's why, like, Laura Dern gets so much love, Scarlett Johansson gets so much love, is people have seen her really run the gamut in the kinds of things that they play. And so they want to reward them when they are in a supporting role or a lead actress role for something that really showcases the range. And I think that's the case for Renee Zellweger. It's definitely one of those situations where the performance is way better than the movie. So whereas Judy was a disappointment to me as a movie, I remember immediately thinking, this is the kind of performance that that the Academy will want to recognize, because they do like to, we know they like to recognize people who can actually, who aren't singers, but do their own singing.
Well, they're still
in these films.
They're still a little stuck. I've never been the biggest fan of J-Lo's performance this year, as it kept getting raves and raves throughout the year from all the guilds. But she was certainly better than Kathy Bates and Richard Jewell. What a throwaway nomination.
I put Kathy Bates in the mix for our WAFCO Awards last month, because I did think that that Kathy Bates was being a bit overlooked, because that movie was getting bashed for reasons that had nothing to do with Kathy Bates and her performance, or the guy who played Richard Jewell and his performance. And so I think it's an acknowledgement of the different roles that one actress sometimes can play. And when you see them pulling off things that are just different than the last few things that you saw them in, perhaps, you just want to reward them for that. So, but I, you know, thinking about it now and looking at this list, yeah, I mean, it's kind of tough. Cynthia Erivo is very good at Harriet Tubman, but that's another one where I think their performance outshined the movie. But you're right, Us, I wish there was a place to put, you know, to put Lupita Nyong'o for Us, because she really, really was good. I would vote for Lupita if she was on this
list. Same here, easy. I wish Cynthia Erivo would win for Best Original Song. Mm-hmm. That's my favorite song of the year. The biggest weird, just what were they thinking in that category, is there's no Glasgow from Wild Rose, but there's the most forgettable song you've ever heard from Toy Story Four.
Yeah, I didn't even remember what it was. I was like, wait a minute, what was the music in Toy Story 4? I think that was the best song category to me was one of the biggest missed opportunities, I think, for the Oscars to draw in, to leave out Beyonce, even though I wasn't a huge fan of her song Spirit in The Lion King.
It's not a very good song at all.
But there was Speechless from Aladdin, which I thought was excellent. But also the Taylor Swift song from Cats, even though Cats is overall a pretty terrible film, her song, Taylor Swift's original song for it, was actually quite beautiful, Beautiful Ghost. And I'll tell you, if you had the Beehive and the Swifties being able watching the Oscars, your ratings would go way up. But I would say expect Cynthia Erivo to knock it out of the park live singing.
She's not
going
to win. They're going to give it to Elton John.
They will probably give it to Elton John. And I'll tell you, I predicted last year right after the Oscars, because Elton John and Taron Egerton sang a duet at the after party of the Oscars last year at Elton John's Vanity Fair party, I think it was. And I remember that it went viral, the clip. And I remember saying, they will be on stage at the next Oscars singing. And so I expect to see a Elton John, Taron Egerton duet on the stage. But I really do think I actually like the Cynthia Erivo song better. And I think that's going to be one of the most memorable performances, because she is a Broadway star too. You know, she can belt it out. She is a live performer, and so I absolutely look forward to seeing her sing. I just hope to God they let the original artist sing these songs.
Another WTF moment was original screenplay. I loved 1917. I love that it's nominated for Best Picture and Best Everything Else with 10 nominations. It does not deserve a nod for Best Original Screenplay.
I agree.
There's no Booksmart, there's no Uncut Gems, and there's no The Farewell. But there is 1917.
Yeah, and that is when you talk about how some of these multiple nominations, people were just stacking the deck and just sort of running the categories. But I'll tell you, my biggest snub, the one I'm still angry about, is that my favorite document, not only my favorite documentary, but one of my favorite films of the year, Apollo 11, didn't make the cut for Best Doc. And I have not seen, we talked about The Cave. The fact that, granted, I'm glad Forsama made the cut, but there was no reason after you saw Forsama for The Cave to even still be in the mix. And I still need to see Honeyland and Edge of Democracy to figure out, where they fall into the mix. But I just felt that Apollo 11 absolutely deserved to be there, especially when you have something like The Cave in there. I'm like, there should have been a spot for it. And I think that it wasn't marketed for your consideration to the proper degree. And so that's a shame because it absolutely should have been in there.
Well, it won every regional or citywide Critics Guild Award for Best Documentary. The Cave's garbage. speaking of documentaries, they 4 out of 5 were directed by women.
There you go. As
opposed to the actual Best Director category, which is, again, 4 gentlemen. The documentaries have 4 female directors. I loved Honeyland. I hope you catch up with it. I don't think you actually like it very much.
We'll see. I'll see it
but
this
a
week.
But a huge surprise is that Honeyland got 2 nominations.
Yes.
It's also nominated, surprisingly, for Best International Film.
And what country is it from? Because I was surprised to see that.
Well, I don't know where they credit it, because it's set in Macedonia.
Is it in English?
No.
Oh, so it's subtitled. Okay. Yeah, we'll see.
Not
but,
in English.
Yeah. It's interesting that I don't think I've really seen or heard much about the fact of that women directed these documentaries.
They did.
And I think, because I remember The Cave was directed by a woman.
Forsama
was directed
by herself.
A woman. Yeah, and so I think that gets a little lost. One thing people talk about Greta Gerwig getting snubbed for Best Director because it's like, how can you have a film that gets six nominations and is considered worthy of all those nominations, and yet somehow the director who puts the whole thing together
it's not worthy
doesn't
of six
get
nominations.
The nomination.
It doesn't surprise me that she got snubbed. She didn't get snubbed. Everyone who got nominated is better than her.
No, but I'm not. That's just it. I was going to say I'm not sure who you boot from the list.
I would put if you.
Except
if you,
I would put. I think I would boot Todd Phillips
well,
from
well,
the
I would
list.
Boot Todd Phillips as well. But if you want to nominate a woman for Best Director, she directed Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
You're still okay. You're stuck on that one. All right, but the good thing is that Greta Gerwig herself seems okay with it. So even though there's been this tremendous backlash, she's kind of like chill people. It's not that big a deal, which I think is nice. It's also why everyone loves Greta Gerwig, and we haven't seen the last of her. The only one that I really feel like I still absolutely need to see is Pain and Glory for Antonio Banderas, because I've not seen that one. He's nominated for Best Actor, and it's nominated for is it Best International Film for that one, too?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's something like Corpus Christi for foreign film. I've never even heard of it.
I've heard of it. It actually has a very interesting premise. I do want to catch up with it. Overall, I thought these were very boring nominations, except now I've got my fingers crossed for my dark horse candidate in Best Cinematography, The Lighthouse.
Oh, my gosh. You know what? It did make the
cut. It's a good-looking film.
It made the cut, and that's the only thing that you could even possibly nominated
well,
for.
It's probably going to lose to 1917.
Should because it's
still
not,
a good-looking film.
It is a weird film.
So, yeah, I'm not.
They're safe.
I'm not excited about these Oscars. They are. It's boring.
It's pretty safe and standard. And, yes, when there are that many multiple nominees, it does diminish, I think, to some degree. And I still want them to go back to just having five in the best picture, because I think it would force them to really pick the top five. I don't think it's fair to have an expanded category for best picture when you don't have room to expand, when there are multiple people being left off of the acting categories. And so that to me is kind of sad. Whether or not these Oscars go off well or not is ultimately going to really rest on the live performances, the pacing.
Well, people always complain, we've never seen any of these foreign independent films nominated for Best Picture. Well, guess what? Everybody's seen Joker and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, so that might actually be in its favor.
I don't know. I'm not sure all that many people have really seen. I mean, Joker.
Everybody's seen Joker.
I don't know. If they have, I don't think there are that many people that would still call it the best film of the year. so I'm most looking forward to when we get the links to the shorts. Because to me, finally watching all those little shorts and being able to pick one on our Oscar pool is a highlight every year, because I always feel that they're really underappreciated, and I'm always shocked at how a 15-minute film can sometimes be so much better than a 2-hour film.
Yeah, frequently they are.
Mm-hmm.
All right, quick recap. Bad Boys for Life. Yeah, whatever.
I mean, it's a franchise film. If you like it, if you're like a Fast and Furious kind of person, I think it's not as good as the first, better than the second. And absolutely just entertaining in a fleeting sort of way.
Doolittle,
it's for the kids. It's a kids movie. So if your kids want to go see it, let them go see it.
Troop Zero,
if you're just sitting around like I was and you're like, what can I just stream for an hour and a half that's going to be kind of a heartfelt, nice film for especially girls. It's really one of those films that's designed for, I would say, the tweenage girls. And the adults will appreciate it, too, because it's got some darn fine acting in it.
The French film Les Misérables is the best film of the week. It is a rough watch, but it's certainly worth it.
It's only worth it if you are a foreign film buff and you're trying to get through all the nominees. It's just a matter of taste and choice.
I'd watch it even if it wasn't nominated.
I don't think it was the best film of the week.
All right. Well, thank you for putting up with us for this episode with sans wine.
but lovely tea.
Very good. On behalf of the Cinema Clash, I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.